This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. For this episode, I'm just going to turn things over to my friend and colleague, Andy Borowitz, who's got something very special in store for us.
On the periodic chart of metal, one band is heavier than the rest. Its atomic weight is 11. Its name is Spinal Tap. Led by singer David St. Hubbins and guitarist Nigel Tufnel, Spinal Tap made music history with their seminal 1984 rockumentary, This Is Spinal Tap. But it was their bassist, Derek Smalls, who left an unremovable mark with his tasty licks on Tap's majestic hit, Big Bottom. Flash forward 34 years. Whatever happened to Derek Smalls? Is he still alive? And more importantly, can he still rock? Well, Derek Smalls answers those questions and some others that no one has asked on his first ever solo album, Smalls Change, Meditations Upon Aging. Derek Smalls, welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Oh, thank you so much.
And you look fantastic. You look alive to me. I'm not a doctor, but you look good.
Well, I feel good. I had a little incident, which is why my chops, my facial hair is not what it used to be. But
what was the incident? Tell me.
I was a friend of mine. It's an old friend, Eddie Dregs. He's moved to Scunthorpe, England. Late summer, early autumn, these strange gusts of wind will sometimes whip up in the countryside. Mm-hmm. I mean, Scunthorpe's not, you know, it's not London, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I was walking down the street and see this little cat, sweet little, you know, tiny little cat, and all of a sudden one of these gusts whips up and whips the cat right into my face.
Oh my gosh.
And the poor thing, you know, claws come out, and so I went to the NHS and they said, we'll be shaving you now, mate. Mm-hmm. And of course the cat didn't know what hit him, especially when I hit him.
Right. Oh, that's terrible. Yeah. But you're rallying now. You're feeling
It's growing back.
Good. Derek, this is
not the cat.
Not the cat.
No,
of course
the cat's not.
Not
growing back.
Cats never will. I did a little bit of research.
Uh-oh.
Before I
know where you're going with this question.
Well, it's an uncomfortable question.
It is.
But I have to bring it up, and I don't mean to.
Do you know what makes it doubly uncomfortable?
What?
Well, you want to tell people what the question is first. I mean, I know where you're going, but they might not.
Well, the question is, I, in preparation, as a journalist, when I sit down to interview somebody, the first thing I do is I Google them and I go to their Wikipedia page to learn as much as possible
about
them.
You're damn good.
It's called just shoe leather journalism. Mm-hmm. It's what I do. And I Googled Spinal Tap and found that Spinal Tap somehow is not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm. Keyword, somehow.
Somehow. How could that be? I mean, are you dumbfounded, flabbergasted? Is it politics? Is the fix out? What is the deal?
I was dumbfounded for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then I did some thinking and research and I became smart-founded. Mm-hmm. Do you know what they sell in the gift shop at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? A T-shirt that says, Hello, Cleveland.
Oh, my God.
First door you sign, authorized personnel only.
Yeah.
Open that door. That's the stage.
You think so?
You authorize. You're musicians, aren't you?
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Rock and roll.
Rock and roll.
Let's get it.
No,
you see this way.
Straight
rock and roll.
Rock and roll.
There we go.
Hello, Cleveland.
something's up. Mm. There's a cover-up going on, and I don't know what it is.
Who do you think could be behind that?
I don't want to name names. Mm-hmm. These people have been named already by their parents. Mm-hmm. But somewhere in the management of that so-called Hall of Fame, so-called Hall of so-called fame, that's all I can say.
Have you, at this point, are you sort of...
I could say it again, but I don't like to repeat myself.
You don't like to repeat yourself. Are you sort of, you and the other guys in the band sort of sawed off, we don't care, you know, this is, are you, or does it still hurt on some level?
Every time I see that they're selling a T-shirt that says "Out of Cleveland in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame,"
right.
It hurts, mate.
It hurts you.
Yeah.
And you don't get a piece of that.
I don't get a piece of the shirt.
No,
a piece of the shirt wouldn't be much.
It would be worthless, probably.
I mean, what?
You need an entire shirt.
You need an entire shirt.
Yeah.
It's now you're editorializing again.
A little bit, because I'm expressing my opinion about what's important in a shirt.
Yeah.
And the whole thing. Not everybody feels that way.
Both sleeves and the neck, please.
Right.
At the very least.
At the very least. This is a question I think a lot of Spinal Tap fans, and I count myself as a huge one.
Thank you. You're what, 6'3"?
About 6'3", 6'4".
Yeah, you are huge.
I'm on the big side.
Yeah.
You know, you're one third of what's been called the loudest band in rock and roll.
I think we were the ones who called us that.
You called yourselves that.
Yeah.
Given that you have that kind of a massive success and that sort of a legacy, what inspired you to step out and record a solo album?
2009, we played Glastonbury Festival in England.
That's a big gig.
130,000 people.
Wow.
Staring at us, wondering. And then we played Wembley Arena, sold it out in London, same week. And I'm thinking, great, here we go. And I go home and, you know, wait for the call. And the telephone doesn't ring.
Mm-hmm. Was the phone working?
I rang the phone company. That's exactly what I did. Mm-hmm. You think like I do. And they said, it's not us, mate. And I realized, great, here we are again. Here we are not again.
Right.
Literally. And so I thought, this is not how it ends for Derek.
Mm-mm.
So
maybe this is how it begins.
Interesting. Yeah, nice. And so I applied. There's a group in England, semi-official, called... I'm wearing their T-shirt, the British Fund for Aging Rockers.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah,
wonderful.
They take the money that was saved in austerity and use it to give grants to aging rockers, hence the name. And I applied, and they said, what's your idea? And I said, my idea is that you give me money and I make a record. And they said, no, what's your idea?
Mm-hmm.
So then I had to do some thinking. And I thought, well, they say write about what you know. What do I know? I know I'm getting older.
Mm-hmm.
I'll write about that.
Interesting.
And so that's what the record is.
Meditations upon aging.
Aging, yeah.
You know, you make a good point. Roger Daltrey famously sang,
Hope I die before I get old.
Where do you stand on dying versus getting old? Have you given this a lot of thought? Do you come down on one side or the other?
I think you have to get old before you die.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the way nature works.
You wouldn't do it the other way around.
I would not do it the other way around. I think it's too much trouble. It's way too much. Too much arrangements have to be made.
So you make this application to the British Fund for Aging Rockers. And you have the money to make the album.
Yes.
Now, your band, Spinal Tap, is behind some really iconic rock songs like Hellhole and Sex Farm.
Mm-hmm.
Was that
Stonehenge?
Stonehenge, of course.
Yeah.
Was that something of a burden of the past that you had to deal with as you were sitting down to write this album?
I didn't want to repeat myself.
No, never.
The worst thing you can do is repeat yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That was one thing I did not want to do, is repeat myself. So I thought, let's take advantage of this by expanding the palette.
Right.
The musical palette. So Tap was always a rock band, a loud guitar-driven rock band. Let's get a symphony orchestra involved.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get other kinds of different musical colors to paint with.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do that. Fire alarm?
I think so. Let's wait for that. Is it a real fire?
Oh, this would be history in the making. We were interviewing Derek when the building burnt down.
I'm just going to quickly make sure that the building's not on fire.
Okay. If it is on fire, are there some more different questions you want me to ask?
Should we talk faster? Faster talk faster.
How do we talk faster?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I wanted to get, I thought I'll get a broader musical palette, get a symphony orchestra, get other colors that to paint with. There's a song called Memo to Willie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Willie, I don't know if you're familiar with British slang. But
I am, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you'll tell people what the Willie is then.
Right. It's an important part of the anatomy, isn't it?
It's the distinguished member from down below.
Exactly.
And I would come to this country, and I would watch the telly, and I'd see these adverts. Nice-looking bloke, late 30s, maybe early 40s. He's got a piece of crumpet with him. And they're out in a rowboat on the lake, or they're strolling down a path in the city, or they're having a good time. It looks like they're about to get it on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, the voice, scary voice, comes on. When the time is right, will he be ready? And I'm thinking, is this an epidemic that I've missed? And it's, it's for these pills.
Right, of course.
And I'm thinking, we don't have this in Britain.
This doesn't happen. The problem doesn't happen, or the remedy doesn't happen.
They don't talk about it.
It's not
on the telly every night. So I just thought, it's not my problem. I make that clear.
Of course not.
Yeah. But here's what you need. Give him a good stern talking to.
Let's listen to a little bit of Memo to Willie. Now, you mentioned that you don't want to repeat yourself in your music, and you want to...
I never want to repeat myself.
You never want to repeat yourself. And this album is full of new sounds. But there are also some, I would say, some thematic lines that you could draw from, say, Spinal Tap to Derek Smalls, solo artist, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I was interested in sort of tracing sort of a thematic line from a song like Big Bottom, which was a big hit for you back in the Tap days, to Butt Call.
You're driving your car. You're walking across the square. Your mobile rings, and there's no
Can you describe how you sort of made the journey from Big Bottom to Butt Call?
You know, when I was a kid, my dad was in the telephone business. He
worked for the telephone company?
No, he had his own company. Well, it wasn't a company. I mean, he was the company, but he had his own van, and he would go about sanitizing telephones, proper telephone handsets, what we used to have. People were concerned about germs. And he made a nice living at it. And now, we've got these little phones, which are germier than anything. I mean, if my dad were alive, he'd have invented a phone sanitizing app.
Of course.
And he'd be,
on the phone itself.
Fabulously wealthy.
Yeah.
But, here's this thing that people, ring you up and they're not even calling you. And it's a butt call.
Right.
So it was not about, let's do another song about butts.
No.
It was going from a whole other place.
That's how with a lot of your music, on first glance, it might seem
simple-minded.
Shallow, but then when you dig deeper, it's less shallow.
It's always less shallow when you dig deep.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's interesting. This is, this is maybe pie in the sky, just fantasy or dreaming big. Mm-hmm. But do you think there's a chance that you might be inducted as a solo artiste in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame now that you've broken out with your own album?
I don't know. You know, to tell you the honest truth, Andy, is it Andy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have to die first.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right.
Which is not my intent.
No. No, you've been very clear about that.
Yeah, rather be alive than in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Right. Well, that's fair. And it's your choice.
It's a choice.
It's your choice. Let me ask, before we move on to something else, because I realize I've touched on a very painful topic, and you're handling it very manfully.
Thank you.
If you could remove anybody from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and take their place, who would that be?
Peter Frampton.
Derek Smalls, thank you so much.
Thank you, Andy.
Derek Smalls of Spinal Tap, as played by the great actor and comedian Harry Shearer. Derek Smalls is fictional, but his solo album is real. You might want to ponder that if you're philosophical. It's called Smalls Change, Meditations Upon Aging. You can read Andy Borowitz at newyorker.com.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code RADIOHOUR at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. When I'm doing my day job, one of my favorite things to do is walk around the halls of the New Yorker and pick the brains of my very informed colleagues and find out what they're listening to, what they're reading, and what they're watching on TV or seeing at the movies. Joshua Rothman is an editor at The New Yorker, and he writes about all kinds of things, philosophy, science, technology. But lately, there's been just one thing on his mind, one very big thing.
That's him. That's pretty recent.
That is a beautiful child.
He's cute.
You done good, Josh.
He's cute. Thank you.
I'm with my colleague, Josh Rothman, who just had a baby, and It was a stunning 11 pounds, 8 ounces, taking the breath away from everybody at the offices here, and my wife and everybody I know. I told about it. I think I told everybody. How's the baby, first of all?
He's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's good-natured, smiley.
Any tricks?
Not yet, but he's starting to sleep for more than 3 hours at a time.
So can he dunk yet?
He can't dunk. He does. He has a real wingspan. So I think there's a football versus baseball debate happening in the...
No football.
It's going to be the Giants.
Ixnay on the football. Ixnay on the football. So you've got some recommendations for parents and all those who love them.
I do.
Fire away.
Okay. So, in the months leading up to his arrival, as one does, my wife and I read like hundreds of parenting books. And the best book that we read was called Expecting Better, and it's by an economist, actually, named Emily Oster. She's a professor at Brown. And basically, the theory is that she, using her statistical skills, does a vast analysis of all of the parenting studies that exist and tells you which ones are meaningful and which ones actually don't. Like past
muster. Wait a minute. This is what you read, not books about like what kind of blankets to use or what to feed the baby or how to get the baby to sleep. You got a statistical analysis from an economist
yep.
at Brown.
And it was awesome. And the big discovery, I mean, I guess if you had to boil it down, it's that being an economist, she's super aware of like socioeconomic factors that confound most parenting studies.
So what did you learn?
So for example, there's a lot of studies saying don't drink while you're pregnant, right? But as we all know, in some countries, people do drink while they're pregnant. So
right. It
kind of makes you wonder, what's the deal? It turns out that most of these studies have some kind of socioeconomic confound, some kind of variable that messes it up. Usually it has to do with the fact that mothers who drink more are poorer than mothers who drink less. Mm-hmm. When you find the studies that actually account for all those variables, all those socioeconomic variables, to which Emily Oster is especially sensitive because she's an economist. It turns out you can have like 1 to 2 glasses of wine and it's fine.
Per day,
which is what people do in other countries. So that's what we did.
How else did it help you?
I think the big thing it made you do was just like use your head instead of being freaked out all the time.
Were you freaked out all the time, anticipating your first child?
Yeah, a little bit, I think. Yeah.
What freaked you out the most?
I guess, like, I had visions of it being a lot scarier than it was, or than it's turned out to be. Mm. Like, I thought that the whole having kids thing would be way less fun, and just way more alarming. Like, the way it was the first, like, couple days in the hospital, where I didn't know what I was doing and felt incompetent and terrified.
That you'd break the baby and so
on. Yeah, exactly, that I'd break the baby.
What else?
Okay, the other thing I did was I read lots of dad blogs. Like tons of dad blogs.
You're making me feel so guilty.
Dad blogs are like unbelievable. They're all obsessed with gear, you know, like baby stuff that dads can buy. A lot of them have a, for lack of a better word, like a tactical sensibility. Like,
what does that mean?
It means a lot of this stuff looks sort of militaristic. And there's a whole kind of like tactical dad, like you're ready for all eventualities. You have a backpack with tons of pockets in it, and it has like a special compartment for diapers and another special compartment for onesies.
So like military cargo pants, but for the baby.
Yeah, somehow I got down this rabbit hole. And there was one blog that I found recommended. It went through the best tiny flashlights for a dad to own to be prepared for anything. And I bought one, and I have it here, and it's awesome. It's made by this company called Raylight.
Wait, you were having a child or going on a
expedition.
An expedition into like the jungles of Indonesia.
So it's like this.
Look at this thing.
Huge brass heavy flashlight.
Oh my God. It looks like it's about 5 inches long, and you would find it buried under the sea in some sort of Jules Verne expedition. The thing weighs 22 pounds.
It's awesome. And the main reason it's great
it's awesome.
Is it has this special low light mode that you can use to inspect like the diaper situation in the dark without waking your kid. So you can go on like
right,
a covert mission.
Little tip here from a longtime parent. You should be able to do that with your eyes closed, my friend.
That might be true.
Sense of smell should give it right away.
Okay. So this has been like the best thing.
I use it
every night.
Okay. Excellent. Okay. We've got a book. We got the flashlight.
Yeah. And then I guess in the year up to when our baby was born, I had read the Norwegian novelist Karl Ove Knausgård has this series of books that he's written that are letters to his unborn daughter. And he wrote four books. They're each named after season. So there's like autumn, winter, spring, summer. Mm-hmm. It's this like hyper sweet concept. And I had read these books. They sort of encouraged you to think about what life would be like for this new person. And they made you think about how when you had this kid, you would like see life differently too. In the first of those books, which is called Autumn, Ken Ausgard has this little essay called Infants, and it's just about babies. So he writes, "Holding an infant close to one's body is one of the great joys in life, perhaps the greatest. This is when the child is newborn and so tiny that the adult's palms nearly cover its little body completely, when its gaze seems to float and only rarely fastens on something in its surroundings. And one senses that for the baby, being in the world is almost exclusively sensual. The warmth and softness of the body that the infant nestles against, the lukewarm milk that fills its tummy, sleep which overcomes it so deliciously every few hours. For the newborn infant, everything revolves around equalizing the differences between itself and the surroundings, getting everything warm, close, soft. A sudden drop in temperature opens a chasm between the infant and reality. So does a sudden sound or a sudden movement, and it screams. Satisfying these simple demands is a pleasure, because they're simple, because doing so involves an interaction, a rhythm, a song, and because the closeness it requires fulfills a wish, which is almost a desire, to protect, to give, to care for."
Joshua Rothman, a newly minted father, reading from Carl Ove Knausgård's essay collection, Autumn. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for today. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.